I'm Tariq Osman, and here on the BBC World Service, it's the third part of my journey uncovering the making of the modern Arab world. Today, I'll be looking at the reasons behind the rise of political Islam.
This is the call to prayer in Islam. Cairo was known as the city of a thousand minarets. Now there are much more than 1,000 mosques in Cairo. Many of them have been built in the last 30 years since the late 1970s with the rise of the Islamist trend in the country and the region.
But it wasn't always like this.
If you look at the images of the Gamal Abdel Nasser funeral, it is very clear. Women at the funeral, and it was one of the biggest, I believe, in history, were not veiled.
Until 1974, you wouldn't find a veiled woman, a veiled female students in Cairo University. It was very liberal. Female students used to wear short skirts.
So what happened to so dramatically change Arab society in the last four decades? In the 1950s and 60s, secular Arab nationalism under the charismatic leadership of its hero, the Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, captured the imagination of the vast majority of Arabs.
Many of the Arab countries are adopting the Arab nationalism. Arab nationalism means Arab independent country cooperating together.
His vision promised to restore national pride and independence. But with a descent into authoritarianism and the defeat of Arab troops in the 1967 war with Israel, that dream started to fade.
The man who in every sense had fought for his country was laid to rest.
Nasser died in 1970, and around 5 million mourners gathered for his funeral procession.
And you can probably hear the crowd shouting their lamentations, shouting, Nasser is good, we love you, we love you.
His death left a political vacuum, which came to be filled by the unexpected resurgence of the movement he had tried to crush, Islamism. In this program, I'm going to explore the many forces which converged and led to that resurgence of political Islam. And I'll be looking in particular at Egypt and Syria, the two countries which have played a central role in the making of the modern Arab world. But let's go back for a moment to 1967 to hear how the pivotal event that shattered one dream created fertile ground for the growth of another. Professor Charles Tripp of the School of Oriental and African Studies.
1967 and the defeat of the Arab armies by Israel saw the defeat of all these regimes that had been claiming to champion Arab republicanism, Arab nationalism, and to foreground the military as their vehicle for transforming the Arab world. And 67 had shown them up to be hollow. And therefore, for many people across the Middle East, there was a disillusionment with Arab nationalism, a disillusionment with Arab socialism. And clearly that meant something that they had to look for instead. And the place that they looked in many ways was a new restatement of Islamic values in public life, feeling that under Islam there would be more honesty, more authenticity.
What is more, some Islamists argued that the reason for their failures was because Arab societies and their leaders had turned away from their faith. Professor Eugene Rogan of the University of Oxford.
The idea was the Arabs would really only restore their rightful place in world affairs when they returned to sound Islamic practices. So no division between religion and society, no prioritizing civil law over religious law. These ideas guided Islamist politicians and became a far more powerful political language than anything in circulation in the 1980s or 90s.
And a key factor in the move towards Islamism was the role played by Nasser's successor, President Anwar Sadat.
The swearing-in of Anwar Sadat completes the form...
Anwar Sadat took over when Nasser died, and he had a very different agenda and a very different outlook.
The Egyptian novelist Ahdaf Suwaif.
He basically wanted to bring Egypt into the American fold, and he wanted to be a hero of peace, and to turn the country around to a more capitalist, more Western-oriented stance, he had to discredit the old Nasserites and the old leftists, and he did that by encouraging the Islamists.
The Muslim Brotherhood, founded in British-ruled Egypt in the 1920s, was by far the biggest of the mainstream Islamist groups, whose aim was to establish an Islamic state based on Sharia law. Under Nasser, they had been suppressed and thousands were imprisoned. Many had been radicalized by the experience. Sadat, however, loosened the restrictions, opened the prisons, and released its members from jail, a move that would later come back to haunt him.
And I remember, in fact, more or less, when he let them loose.
Dr. Hossam Abdallah was a student activist in the 1970s at Cairo University.
There was a strike in the university, and these guys came with chains in their hands, attacking all of us in the Faculty of Engineering, the Faculty of Medicine, and so on. All of a sudden, let loose on all the people on the left in the university.
Many of the members of the Muslim Brotherhood were also professionals, like doctors, engineers, and lawyers, as Dr. Sami Zubaida of Birkbeck College explains.
While the Muslim Brotherhood remained officially prohibited in Egypt under Sadat, in practice it was given plenty of opportunities for organization, for publications, and especially for the organization of students in universities, and also of professionals, you know, like the Doctors Association, the Lawyers Association, and so on. So in fact, Islamist ideology and propaganda, preaching and piety, were facilitated and encouraged.
Sadat himself cultivated his image as a pious Muslim.
He insisted on being called al-Ra'is al-Mu'min, the pious president.
Professor Fawaz Girgis of the London School of Economics.
He used to go every Friday to the mosque. He used to walk in a particular way, his beads in the hands. He came across as a pious man, the pious president.
Then, in 1973, came a momentous event that shook the West and changed the balance of power in the Arab world.
The era of cheap fuel and cheap energy is over.
We are heading toward the most acute shortages of energy since World War II.
He and his fellow Arab leaders changed the balance of economic power in the Western world.
The Arab oil embargo against the US and its allies after the 1973 Yom Kippur War caused chaos in the West. It resulted in fuel shortages and set oil prices soaring. But more importantly to the story of Islamism, the huge influx of petrodollars for the Arab oil-producing states cemented the regional influence of conservative Gulf countries, in particular Saudi Arabia.
The Saudi Kingdom has two major exports, oil and Islamic fundamentalism.
Professor Gilbert Ashkar of the School of Oriental and African Studies.
They are somewhat connected because the oil wealth is used in promoting Islamic fundamentalism. In the broad sense of fundamentalism, which is people who stick to literalist interpretations of religion, their own brand, their own very Puritan, very conservative interpretation of Islam, what is called Wahhabism.
This is the visa section of the Saudi embassy for 20, 25 years from the mid-1970s. Millions of Egyptians, teachers, doctors, nurses, engineers, would stand in long queues applying for visas to get the chance to immigrate to Saudi Arabia, searching for job opportunities.
The same dynamic was taking place right across the region. Millions of Syrians, Lebanese, Jordanians, Moroccans, Tunisians, and Yemenis had also immigrated to the Gulf for work, and they were absorbing the values of these highly conservative societies. Dr. Hiba Handusa is a leading Egyptian socio-economist, and she told me how the social face of Egypt began to change.
I used to go regularly as an advisor to the Minister of Industry, four ministers in a row, and I could see it happen. You know, I was wearing short sleeves and I felt embarrassed and had to wear longer sleeves because ultimately you don't want to be the odd one out. You know, it was also shocking when you felt that in some cases people were pushing young students to do it. I know in some faculties where there were a lot of Brotherhood active students, they would really work on the young ones to get them convinced of what was the right path.
Dr. Lale Khalili says several reasons were in play.
If the state is very outspokenly secular, it could be that people try to use reveiling or pious markers as a way of challenging the state. Some of it is, of course, fashion. Some of it is truly a return to religion.
Not surprisingly, the liberal and progressive Islamic thinking that had shaped Egyptian and Arabic society in the first half of the century during an-Nahda or the Renaissance was being sidelined by an opposing trend, that of a strict Salafist Islam steeped in the past. And it was this puritanical current coming from the most conservative part of the Arab world which increasingly marginalized the country's liberals and intellectuals. Growing up in the 60s, the Egyptian novelist Ahdaf Swaif observed that cultural decline.
Certainly in the 60s, as a teenager, I was very aware of a culture of flowering, of a lot of theater, a lot of music, a lot of interest in the arts, a lot of international stuff coming in. And this all receded through the 80s, the 90s.
Meanwhile, Sadat had made another fateful decision that was to fuel discontent and anger amongst Egypt's most deprived groups and help drive them towards the Islamists. The open door policies, or infitah, as it was known, was Sadat's strategy to break away from Nasser's socialism and liberalize the Egyptian economy and encourage foreign investment, a vision he believed would result in prosperity for his people. But it resulted in shocking gaps in income and created crony capitalism, which enriched a few while impoverishing large segments of the population.
This opens a space, a big space.
Dr. John Shalcraft of the London School of Economics.
For Islamists to, if they deliver on charity, if they deliver locally in a non-state way, the famous example of the blankets that the Islamists bring to the Cairenes who are made homeless by the 1992 earthquake. Oh, who's running the health clinics? Who's bringing the blankets? Who is opening kindergartens? Who's giving books on campus in Egypt in the 1970s? When the state is not providing them, they've become more expensive. It's Islamists. So there are all these reasons why this kind of analysis of the situation can start to capture a certain segment of the population, because of course it never captures everybody by any means.
It is this highly effective social infrastructure targeted at the poor and needy that really cemented the Islamic movement's social re-emergence and positioned them as the provider.
It's all about extending their influence in civil society.
Professor Charles Tripp.
Not just to rally support, because they think it's actually part of their civil duty to do so, their Islamic duty. And for the Egyptian government, that was sometimes quite threatening because they were, in a sense, displacing people's loyalties.
The posters above the cafe say Islam is the solution.
And then in 1979 came three pivotal events that radicalized and internationalized Islamism.
It was quite simply the biggest demonstration ever staged in Iran.
This has been the day of the revolution. In a day-long orgy of violence, the people seized control from the Shah's government and all it stood for. In one fell swoop, it seemed, Iran had become an Islamic republic.
I have signed a treaty of peace with our great neighbor, with Egypt.
Let there be no more wars or bloodshed between Arabs and Israelis.
The ramifications of the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan are enormous.
Key positions are held by Soviet troops.
Such gross interference is in blatant violation of accepted international rules of behavior.
1979 is a very significant year because there are these events of the Iranian Revolution, the Washington Treaty signed between Israel and Egypt, and then the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And in all three areas, one could argue that they were both inspirational to some, but deeply opposed and controversial to others.
These three consecutive events were to have long-term repercussions across the region. The Iranian Revolution inspired the Islamists. The peace treaty angered them. And the Afghan War proved to be the training ground for jihadists heeding the call for a holy war against the atheist communist invaders. Its effects are still being felt to this day.
Afghanistan became the baptism by blood and fire of a new generation of Sunni religious activists who really believe they can change the destiny and the landscape throughout the Muslim world.
And the West, in the Cold War logic of the time, believed that anyone who was an enemy of my enemy could be my friend, and therefore worked through Islamist organizations in Afghanistan and encouraged a kind of jihad against the Soviet occupiers, certainly assisted by states such as Saudi Arabia.
More importantly, on the battlefields in Afghanistan, a particular fertilization took place between Egyptian radical Islamism and Saudi Salafism. This created what we call Al-Qaeda and the new jihadi Salafi wave that has been raging in the region since the late 1990s.
In Egypt, Syria, and many other Arab states, social inequality, rampant corruption, and political repression were leading to mounting discontent. In Egypt, as the Islamists became more critical, Sadat became more repressive.
There was also a wing of the Islamist movement in Egypt that had come out of the prison camps with a much more embittered attitude.
The demonstrations against President Sadat have been building up for some time.
They believed that Anwar Sadat was a crony of the Americans, was insulting Islamic leaders, was really behaving as a dictator, as a pharaoh.
Sadat himself, who let out these forces from jail and let the genius out of the bottle, ended up being assassinated by a group of hardline Islamic fundamentalists.
President Sadat of Egypt is dead. He was assassinated at a military parade in Cairo, apparently by a group of his own soldiers, who opened fire on the president and other
dignitaries. Sadat was assassinated on live TV. But let's freeze the frame on this scene for a moment and find out what was happening to the Islamist movement elsewhere. The Islamist movement had spread from Egypt to Syria in the 1930s and 40s, and by the 60s, they were the main opposition to the secular nationalist Ba'ath regime. And whilst Anwar Sadat had given more freedom to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, in Syria, it was a different story. Professor Charles Tripp again.
Both the Muslim Brotherhood, but also more radical Islamist groups, were active in other parts of the region as well, for very similar reasons, against the forms of power that the military and nationalist regimes practiced. And in Syria, for example, the great falling out between the Islamist current and Hafez al-Assad's regime had happened throughout the 1970s.
The Brotherhood rose to challenge Hafez al-Assad, who was from the minority Alawite sect rather than the Sunni majority. Some argue that the conflict was primarily sectarian, others that it was a battle between an oppressive regime and its opponents. Either way, the result was a conflict that claimed the lives of thousands of Syrians.
The confrontation between Islamism and the regime became more and more violent, with atrocities being committed on both sides. And the culmination, of course, was the attempt by the Muslim Brotherhood to seize the city of Hama in 1982. They seized the city and then were isolated in the city. So the regime surrounded it and eventually bombarded it to such a degree that tens of thousands of people were killed, flattened the city, reoccupied it, and that was effectively the destruction of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria.
BBC correspondent Lina Sinjab told me about a difficult personal memory.
That was after Hama. The forces of the Assad government went into the streets, street by street, door by door, woman by woman, car by car, stripping all the Damascene women of their headscarves. Imagine how humiliating is that for a conservative society. And my mother was one of them. This female officer came to the car and stripped her off her scarf and used her scarf for dancing. My mother came back home at that day and she could never put her eyes in any of our eyes. She didn't talk to anyone. And she started knitting. And since that day, she never talked about this event.
Whilst the Islamist movement in Syria was decisively crushed and driven into exile, back in Egypt, Sadat's assassination in 1981 was to mark the start of a wave of violence by radical Islamist groups. His vice president, Hosni Mubarak, who was sitting next to Sadat, received a bullet in the wrist and a message in the head. He needed to take control. Max Rodenbeck.
When Mubarak came to power, there was a backlash by the state against Islamist radicals. So during the 1980s, for example, Mubarak allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to come back into political life, continuing the trends started by Sadat, while punishing more radical jihadist groups. And this trend took a tougher turn towards the end of the 1980s, when some of the more radical groups began to grow in strength.
But the 80s witnessed the return of a powerful and dangerous fringe.
9 years and 15,000 deaths after going into Afghanistan, the last Soviet troops were finally coming home.
Remember the Mujahideen? After the Soviets' defeat and withdrawal from Afghanistan, they felt they had succeeded in their jihad. The militant fighters returned to their native countries with a belief they could achieve their next mission, to install Islamic rule in their homelands by force. And many Arab countries, especially Egypt, were to endure a long decade of violence in the name of Islam. From the late 70s to the late 90s, the religious militants carried out more than 700 attacks against officials, tourists, and ordinary Egyptians.
Travel companies are starting to bring hundreds of British tourists back from Egypt.
This culminated in perhaps the bloodiest incident of all, in Luxor in southern Egypt, in 1997.
British tourists were among about 70 who were killed when Islamic militants opened fire.
The effect on the country's tourist industry was devastating. Mubarak cracked down heavily on the militants and arrested thousands. Max Rodenbeck.
This massacre, which was horrific and shocked everyone in Egypt, including, I think, the Islamist radicals themselves, they couldn't believe that a splinter group had done something quite so mad. There was a switch away from violence, in Egypt at any rate, and the government could declare victory, basically, over that round of terrorism.
Many of them renounced violence. Others fled Egypt and formed offshoots abroad. Amongst them was Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current leader of Al-Qaeda.
People don't realize that Ayman al-Zawahiri's generation led the near-enemy revolt against the Mubarak regime. Yet, by mid-1990s, they lost the fight. And they started really debating on their next steps. What do we do? Ayman al-Zawahiri and a group of Islamists, along with Osama bin Laden, decided that the most effective ways to rescue the Islamist ship was to change the target from the near enemy to the far enemy. The far enemy meaning the United States and the Western powers.
I put it to Max Rodenbeck and Yusra Ghannouchi, the daughter of Sheikh Rashid Ghannouchi, a leading Islamic thinker in North Africa, that the mainstream Islamist movement had been tarnished by the acts of the radicals.
Extremism in the name of Islam has been a great problem, and that is why there is great hostility between the mainstream moderate Islamic movement and the extreme radical violent ones, which is a fact that many wish to not talk about. However, although the moderate Islamic movement has a role to play in promoting peaceful activism and engagement, the state remains the main dispenser of violence in the Arab world against all political opponents.
There's no question that almost every time there's been a turn towards radicalization, it's been as a response to action by the state. You know, whenever the state has cracked down, it's created a disgruntled group, a more radical group that has gone on to do more radical things.
If we look at the history of Islamism in the Arab world in the 20th century, often they were ideologists and pragmatists, anti-colonialists and collaborators, fanatics and social reformers. And often they were just pawns of others. Professor Eugene Rogan.
Many governments made the mistake to believe that they could harness religious enthusiasm to counter-effect the danger of nationalism. It was something that Sadat tried to do in harnessing the support of the Muslim Brotherhood to his own regime. It's something we have seen foreign governments such as the Americans and backing the Taliban while they were fighting against the Soviet Union, or indeed the way in which the government of Saudi Arabia has tried to deploy Wahhabism as a shield to protect them against nationalism. But the thing that local governors or foreign powers overlook is that the moment you begin to play on religious sentiment, you set in motion forces well beyond your control. And any ruler, foreign or domestic, who believed they might control the religious impulse and contain it to advance their own goals and go no further has been shown to be deeply wrong. And they have, almost without exception, had to pay a high consequence for making that mistake.
By the end of the 90s, the radicals were discredited in their home countries. Having failed to gain popular appeal amongst ordinary Arabs or to topple any Arab rulers, either monarchies or republics, they had taken their jihad abroad. But mainstream Islamists had also failed. Not a single Arab country had become an Islamic state. The leaders they opposed, Mubarak, Assad, Gaddafi, Bin Ali and others, remained firmly in power. In the next and final program in the series, we'll find out how these regimes were to face a very different challenge. The frustrations and aspirations of a new, dynamic generation of young Arabs. You've been listening to The Making of the Modern Arab World, presented by me, Tariq Osman, and produced by Shuku Amirani. The BBC.